Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to the Change Starts Here podcast, a research edition. I am joined by my co-hosts and colleagues and pals, Kim Yaris and Jennifer Chevalier. Hello, ladies.
Hello.
Hi. And I am very excited to be leading out on this episode because it is metacognition. And as Kim and Jennifer know, this is a topic I have been looking forward to talking about all season because this is just the topic I could talk about all day long because I believe it is the foundation of our ability to learn, our ability to improve, our ability to like make cultural shifts and do great things as a society. And so it is just so exciting to me. And it was also a great challenge to decide of this topic that I love so much. Where do we go with it? Like, which of the many places that I wanted to go should we go? So I'm going to start by just defining it. I think most educators know what metacognition is, but just to make sure we're all on the same page, metacognition is this idea of thinking about thinking. And that is like a very basic definition, but it really is the way that we are aware of our thinking, what we know, what we don't know, and how we know it, why we think that way, all these different aspects. So because it is our ability to actively think about thinking, I want to start by talking about one of my favorite topics from cognitive science and neuroscience to kind of draw the difference between the two, also just because it's really fun. And that is cognitive biases.
Oh, I thought you were going to say dinosaurs.
Oh, I'll see if I can work them okay. In somehow. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So cognitive biases are kind of these illusions of thinking that are pretty common among a lot of us. And they are times at which we are just kind of on autopilot in making decisions and judgments. So my favorite thing about cognitive biases are all the wild names that are out there for some of these more obscure forms of cognitive bias. So I'm going to share a couple of names. These are all real, of cognitive biases. And I would like both of you to share what you think this bias is just based on the name. Are y'all ready?
I guess so. I'm not even sure if I know what a cognitive bias is, but I'm excited to see if I can piece it together.
Okay. Fair enough. Here's an example of one of the most common cognitive biases. That would be like the availability heuristic. So that is like after something happens where after seeing news reports about a plane accident or about a car accident, then you become far more aware of plane accidents or of car accident. Like, because you can bring one thing to mind, you start to see it everywhere. Okay. You start to go, oh, well, everyone's like that. Or if you notice it, like a word that people are starting to use, like a few years ago, it was like literally. It's like everyone's saying the word literally all the time, literally all the time. So that would be an example of we're just bringing to mind, and it's just on this autopilot of we think that's happening. It's far more common than it actually really is in reality.
Got it.
Does that make sense? Okay. Mm-hmm. So here is a cognitive bias. And I just want you to give a silly guess. So the IKEA effect.
So what is it? The IKEA effect?
Yeah. Go ahead and just give your definition of it, knowing nothing about it except its name.
So the IKEA effect is when you buy lots of stuff because it is a much better price than other places.
I don't think that's good at all. Mm-mm. I think the IKEA effect is the use of graphic representation for directions. And so you suddenly start giving directions to everyone through pictures and illustrations of stick figures doing different things and putting things together.
Well done. Well done. Both are wrong, but I think that they're very creative. So the IKEA effect is the bias that leads individuals to place a disproportionately high value on objects they partially assembled themselves, regardless of the quality of the end result. Ooh. So essentially, it's this idea that the more effort you put into creating something, the more you value it. Like, ooh, even if it is not as valuable as, you know, that family heirloom, you're like, but I made that dresser. So people, you know, that's the IKEA effect. So here's another one. This one's fun. I've got a few here. So I'm going to go with the cheerleader effect.
The cheerleader effect is people expect that you are going to be perky and enthusiastic regardless of how inappropriate it would be.
These are good. These are good. Okay, Jennifer?
I think the cheerleader effect has to do with people assuming that cheerleaders are not athletes, and so they underestimate the athletic ability of cheerleaders because they don't fully understand all that goes into cheerleading because it is highly athletic.
This is fascinating. Very good. But no, you're both wrong. No, but those were seriously good. So the cheerleader effect is, it's like not as great as either of your examples. It is a bias that suggests that people appear more attractive in a group than in isolation.
Oh, so we're looking pretty good right now because there's three of us.
Don't go alone. Don't go. I can never do my own podcast. it might be due to the averaging out of individual features within a group, making everyone look more average and thus more attractive. So careful how you choose your friends, I suppose. I'm going to give just another, I would love to keep going with this, but, you know, we have a relatively short podcast, so I will keep it to an end. I do have a Ben Franklin one that I'll tell y'all later. So examples like this, so like a confirmation bias is another one where it's a tendency to search for an interpret or favor and recall information in a way that confirms our pre-existing beliefs about people or things, right? Like, so if we go to a place where we've had a bad experience and anything bad happens, we go, oh, here it goes again. Or, I think a lot of people call that the airport or the TSA, you know, area of the airport. So, you know, it's like, it's that type of example where someone's just dreading it because they had one experience. And so that's another like common example. And why I bring all of this up around metacognition is because, first off, those are funny. And also because we spend so much of our lives in just automatic, like our thinking, our choices. And that is actually something that the brain does because we have limited brain energy, this glycogen that is in our brain, to like do that effortful thinking. So our brain is naturally adapted to put a lot of things on autopilot. I don't know if y'all have ever driven home and you kind of don't remember driving home or you're on a walk. Have you ever had that experience?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Uh-huh, yeah. I think most people do, or you need to build in a new errand on your way home. Like you need to pick up the dry cleaning or something. And you just drive all the way home, or you're supposed to go to a friend's house and you end up driving home, making lots of driving examples. But the idea is we're just on autopilot. Some say that it's like up to 80% of the time. And when we're on autopilot, while this is protective of the brain, while this is a natural tendency, what it doesn't provide for us is the opportunity to check our thinking and to check our knowledge. And so this is the basis of metacognition and why it is an actual skill that we can build and that we all have the capacity to get better at, and why it can be life-changing and shift our ability to learn is because when we bring something to mind, it takes it out of the automatic. And what we do with a thought or our ability to think about our knowledge in that moment where we are actually thinking about our thinking, that every time we do that, that builds new patterns, new choices that over time can become automatic, but they can also be, they can serve us better. So in the case of, I'm giving examples that are very tied to like mental well-being. So we know that, I mean, one of the latest reports I saw was 71% of students indicate, this is just from 2024, that they face mental health challenges, and 78% of them say that that's the same or worse than last year. And while there's other indicators that say that the mental health crisis for our school-age students is getting better, it's still a constant challenge right now. And so just knowing some of these like skills that we're helping them build can support other paths, other things in their lives for the rest of their life, it's really powerful. So imagine it's ultimately anxiety and depression that is not clinical. It is all based on patterns of thinking. And so things like, have you heard of cognitive behavioral therapy?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So there's actually also a metacognitive therapy. I did not know this, preparing for this. And it actually is becoming quite popular because it actually causes you to think about your thinking and how to improve it. And so there's this really powerful piece there around mental well-being. But because we are here talking to educational leaders and educators, I really want to shift this to our ability to build learning through metacognition. So before we kind of shift into the role of metacognition in learning, I just want to kind of explore your classroom experiences as educators using metacognition. So I've asked both of you to just share a simple example of metacognition, how you taught it, how you realized you were using it, and kind of the impacts of that. So Jennifer, do you want to hop in there and share your experience using metacognition?
Sure. Something that came to mind right when I read that question that you wanted us to consider before this episode was working with students with disabilities. And metacognition is really challenging. And what I found with some students is they don't even understand their own thinking to be able to then think about their thinking. And so when I was a math coach, I found that having students say out loud what they were doing when they were solving a math problem, like first I'm going to line up the digits so that the ones columns are lined up, like all of those things then put them in touch with their thinking. And they would go silent at times, and I have to remind them, like, what are you doing now? Say it out loud. And then once they got to the place where they could really understand their thinking, then it was like, okay, now that you've done that and like reflecting on it, what went easily? What was challenging? What are you a little uncertain of? And just giving them some questions to help them evaluate their thought process so that they could improve.
So the example that came to my mind is reading aloud to kids, right? So you're reading aloud and the author's just like dropped a hint about what's going to happen. So in that moment, I might think aloud like, oh my gosh, is somebody going to jump out from behind that door? And then I would read on and maybe that would happen. And in that moment, I would say, wait a minute, how do you think I knew that that's what was going to happen? And so we would just kind of retrace the clues that popped up in the story that we were reading aloud that would say that. So it was always very organic. I always felt like kids thought that there was some sort of magic that happens in order to understand what they were reading. And it was just kind of natural to start talking about how I knew what was going to happen was going to happen. And it was almost became like a fun game for them to play along and participate in figuring out how we knew that was going to happen.
That is very cool. Thank you both for those examples. I think it kind of brings it into the world of, you know, education, into the classroom. And maybe for some listening, you might not even think of, you might not have thought about those things as teaching a metacognitive strategy. But I mean, in both of those examples, that could have been used for the very young, like in your example, Kim, you know, and scaled up to older development. But also like the example that you gave, Jennifer, it certainly could be at any age, just like making them aware, helping them to think through their thinking. I was reading back to an article that just talked about different ways that students get, like, they get in their own way around, like, when they're taking a test and things like that. And the ways that metacognition can play into this. I just want to put that out there. Are there ways that you have found as an educator, as students are preparing to take a test, that you are encouraging them just kind of naturally or as more of an explicit strategy to use metacognitive practices?
I'm not sure if it's necessarily something I did in preparation for a test, but when they're figuring things out, like just kind of teaching them to backtrack. And, you know, I think that metacognitive strategies in teaching reading are pretty pervasive. Like, you know, like, how did you figure that out? How do you know that that word is such and such? Or, you know, if you want to know what's going to happen next, how are you going to do that? I just think that there's a lot of language that we use that asks students to reflect on how they know, so that it kind of demystifies the process.
And if I may jump in here, I think that is when I was reading an Edutopia article that was from several years ago that was talking about as they prepare for testing. Because I was kind of putting y'all on the spot there. So I just want to put a couple of these different ways out there to what you were saying about so many of the strategies kind of look like this. I think it's kind of interesting to see some of these common issues and see if that, if you can relate to any of those or if that brings up something for you. So the author of this article, and this will be in the show notes as well, the link to this, talks about three reasons why students are often not prepared for tests. And so the first one is the students have, well, this is another cognitive bias. It's the Dunning-Kruger effect, which is they think that they know more about a topic that they're being tested on than they really do. So they have this false sense of mastery. And so that can often come from just simple things like they think they go through a passage in a book and they go, oh yeah, I remember that. I remember studying like that too. Like, I'd look at the vocabulary words that I had highlighted, and then I wondered why I didn't do well on a test. Well, I didn't have another kind of metacognitive check, right? So the second one is they haven't, it's very related, they haven't checked for understanding, or there hasn't been those moments of checking for their understanding. And so there's been kind of an assumption that everyone gets it because they're not asking questions. And then the final one is kind of tied to some of these fixed mindset ideas. It's like they are walking into that thinking a certain thing about themselves and testing, or thinking something about themselves being ill-prepared and, oh, I'm not good at tests. I'm not good at math. I'm not good at this. And we know from research outside of Carol Dweck, but also like the Pygmalion effect and things like that, where if you tell them that they are in a certain group that's really good at math, you know, they're going to do better. So there is this whole like unaware piece of them telling themselves that they're just not going to do well. So with those three that were brought up in this Edutopia article, I'm curious if y'all have run into any of those in your own teaching experiences.
I'm sure that I have. Nothing's jumping to mind right away. Kim, anything that you wanted to add there?
Oh, all of them, I would say. All of them. You know, I cannot count the times that I had students say, but I studied. And when we poke at that a little bit, well, what did that look like? I looked over my notes, right? And how long did you do that? 5-10 minutes, right? Why would you only do it 5-10 minutes? Because you thought you knew it, right? So, so they weren't exactly sure of, you know, their confidence about how well they knew it was overly confident, right? They look at it when it's sitting there on the page, they get that, right? But knowing is being able to put it in a new context or apply it to whatever the test is going to have, not just, you know, recite the definition perhaps. But even that is easier when you're looking at a piece of paper than when you're trying to recall it, cold when you're sitting in a testing situation.
You bringing that up, Kim, makes me think of a poster I used to have in my classroom, and I would model using it. And then it didn't take long before I would see the kids referencing it. But let's see if I can remember the questions. It was basically like metacognitive talk, and it was organized in things you would do before you started a task, things that you would think about when you were in the middle of the task, and then things you would think about at the end. And the questions were something like, have I done a task like this before? What strategies worked last time? That's what you would think of before you got started. And then there's like a check-in point, like, how am I doing? What should I do next? Do I need a different strategy, right? To help them reflect in the midst of the process. And then at the end, it would be more like, did I get the results I expected? Mm. Or is there anything I still don't understand? Or, what would I do differently next time? Those types of things. And I don't think I really realized what that poster was doing at the time that I was a classroom teacher. But once I became an instructional coach and saw it like on a grander scale and how it worked, that's when I was like, this is so powerful.
Mm-hmm. So I actually have a list of some of those questions, and I think you nailed those. So we will just share those out in the show notes. But what it brought to mind for me is I just want to make sure that this point is made, and that is metacognition, the power of it in the classroom is the ability to build self-regulated learners. And as you say that, it's like putting up that poster and giving them those instructions, that is so powerful. Like, even though that's an external cue and it's not internalized yet, that helps them to internalize the types of questions they can ask themselves to make that unconscious, automatic way of going about preparing and evaluating themselves after makes it more conscious. And then they can build their ability of knowing and knowing how to know. So I think that's very powerful. So the list, we'll share out a list of those in the show notes and strongly encourage people to put up a poster of them. So I know that we're right at time. So I just want to, I know we so often talk about best practices. I'd like to end by asking a question. I've probably ruined it, but can you both briefly respond to this statement? Metacognition is always a powerful strategy for learning. Why or why not? Do you like agree or do you disagree? And why or why not?
I agree, because when we focus solely on content and just learning content, we just learn that content. But if we focus on metacognition, what we do is empower students to learn that content and any other content that they may learn. So learning about learning and knowing how to learn has a much broader applicability than just learning content.
To build on what you just said, I certainly agree. It's like we're teaching kids how to think, not what to think, when we're in that land of metacognition. And while the what is important because we want to make sure that they're meeting all their standards and developmentally growing on all their academic areas, the longer term win is for them to know how to think.
Those are fantastic once again. I think you are so right in the ways that we've been talking about it, and you've been primed to think about this as, like, you know, the good ways. So I just want to share some of the ways that metacognition can go wrong so that we can make sure we are, you know, addressing some of those. So a couple examples of the ways that metacognition can get off is when students bring something to mind, like when they're solving a problem, going back to a previous episode, when they're solving a problem and they get stuck in the, like, over analysis, right? If they're spending too much time thinking through something or thinking about the wrong aspects of it, or they think, you know, they can only, you know, solve the problem with certain aspects of, or like certain variables, that can be a way that they could really actually limit themselves. So I'm just giving a few examples here. I'm sure y'all could think of others. But it's just a way to say, if we just put it out there, let's also make sure that we're aware of some of the ways that students could misinterpret it. If we just release them without some structure around it. So another example is choosing the wrong strategy. So if they're encouraged to self-reflect at the end of learning something new, some students may interpret the self-reflection as a need to focus on only their weaknesses. And because some might hear reflection as, oh, I need to think about what I did wrong, and they could ignore the many strengths that they had. So building in structure, encouraging certain kinds of thinking that are more constructive, because that's the pathway we want to build is, yes, what did you get wrong? But also, what strengths do you have to overcome them? Or what would you do next time? We're building towards greater every time we learn. And one final one around group work. So in a group project that, you know, we do love these group projects, students could become overly controlling, or, like, you know, saying, why are you doing it this way? Or, like, in, you know, and setting other students up to think about their own thinking more negatively, or to process, you know, parts of the project as, you know, needing to be constantly monitored and controlled. So they're thinking about their thinking, but also thinking, I don't know how to do this, and so I'm going to pass off the thinking to this person. That can also be in with teachers too. So I think that these are just, you know, a couple things to keep in mind and ways to think through, how am I teaching? Am I teaching metacognition, making sure that it's there in the things that students are learning, the ways that they're building self-regulated learners, but also in the ways that I'm structuring it so it's teaching them about growth and about getting better and how to learn about themselves in ways that build towards their future. So that is where we're going to end today. There's so much more to say. Thank you, ladies, for participating and being great co-hosts. And thank you all for listening. And if this content is useful to you, we sure would love for you to like this episode and follow along with us at the Change Starts Here podcast so that you can be in on the know with the latest research insights on education and join our discussions further. Be sure to check out the show notes, because we put a ton of great content in there, and we've referenced a lot of things. And until next time, y'all, take care.
See you.